Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. And straight ahead on the program, Good Friday is coming, but will it be a good Friday for the March jobs report from the Labor Department? I'm Tom Busby in New York.
I'm Caroline Hepke in London, where we're looking ahead to President Joe Biden's visit to Northern Ireland.
I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong. How much surprise might be coming in the shuffling of chairs at the BOJ?
I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. We'll take a look at the political ramifications of Donald Trump's indictment.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 991 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, DAB Digital Radio London, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Tom Busby, and we begin the program with the March jobs report. It's coming this Friday. Yes, this Friday is a market holiday. All U.S. stock and bond markets will be closed, but the report is coming out anyway. Joining me now with a sneak peek of what to expect, Bloomberg's global economics and policy editor, Michael McKee. Welcome, Michael.
I'll be working. I can warn you that. Because we do have the numbers coming out, and we are expecting it to be a reasonably good Friday if you're somebody who's employed. Jobs created, they're forecasting 240,000. So that's what would qualify, Tom, as progress these days, because we've been in the fives and threes the last couple of months. So we're looking for a slowdown, and I guess 240,000 would sort of constitute that. But it's definitely not recession territory, at least as far as the Economist survey.
Yeah, still strong. I mean, like you said, January, over 530,000. February was strong. And despite the rash of layoffs we've seen, especially in the tech sector, I mean, is this really unusual that it's still expected to be so strong for March?
It is a bit unusual, but then everything is coming out of this pandemic. We saw so many people lose their jobs at once during the pandemic, and then it's been very difficult to get everybody fitted back into the places that they were before, especially the lower income, lower status jobs that people don't really want to do. It's been hard for bars and restaurants to hire waiters and waitresses and bartenders and things like that, and you know, lawn service people, things like that. So those service industries are still hiring, still raising wages, which kind of puts the onus on the average hourly earnings. We'll see if those slow down at all. The forecast is for a little bit of an increase on a month-over-month basis, but a drop year-over-year. And so the Fed will be watching this closely, as they have with all the jobs reports, because they want to see how much strength the economy still has.
And, you know, you talked about weakness in some services sector, bars, restaurants, hotels. But where is the strength in the jobs market?
It's been in some places you wouldn't necessarily expect. We have seen strength in manufacturing still, although that is starting to fade because now, of course, you have manufacturing. People are not buying goods, as many goods. But we've also seen strength in construction, which has been a surprise because We know housing is in trouble, and builders had been cutting back. They seem to be moving forward again now, but construction's been strong, and retail. Now, the retail thing is a little bit tricky, and since this is Bloomberg, I can be a little bit nerdy. The seasonal adjustment factors come into it at the beginning of the year, because normally you hire a lot of people in the late fall for the holiday shopping period, and then you let them go in January, February. But it seems like it was harder to hire people people this year, and there's labor hoarding going on. Companies don't want to get rid of people, so seasonal adjustments are making retail sales look really good too.
And that's, I think, a surprise to everybody. The retail sales, I believe, in February, the biggest gain was in department stores, percentage-wise.
Yeah, and I don't think we'll see that again, because that was probably done by the overall seasonal factor that we didn't get rid of as many people as we usually do. So it'll probably be another category. It'd be interesting to see if it is construction, if that stays strong, because we're going to start getting into the better weather when you'd think construction would pick up. And then, of course, all the storms out in California and the tornadoes down south mean more home building. So we'll see if those categories stay strong.
And let's talk about the wage component, because you brought up that some of these very hard-to-find jobs, some of the lowest-paying ones, lawn care and bars and restaurants, these owners are forced to hike the wages to attract more people. And is that lifting all boats? And you know, is that still a problem for the Fed's role in trying to drive inflation lower by driving wages lower?
Well, it is a problem for the Fed, and it's basically something they hope will naturally cure itself as people get more, as more people go to work in those categories, and then they don't have to offer as much money, the employers, to get people to take those jobs. But we have seen a decline in the labor force, and so we don't have as many people available to take the jobs. So it's something that the Fed is keeping an eye on. We had the PCE core rate ex housing out on Friday, and that's the one that the Fed follows, because outside of the construction workers for housing, they're looking at services industry hiring, and basically that came down significantly to just a 0.3% gain for the month of February. So maybe we still see some more progress with that.
Yeah, and it looks like you know, vindication for the Fed's plans that, hey, this may be working.
Yeah, it may be working.
Maybe.
And I talked to Susan Collins, the Boston Fed president, on Friday, and she basically told us that it is working, but we have a lot more to go. We have a lot farther to go. I mean, inflation has fallen, but it's still double or more the Fed's target. And so they're going to keep raising rates. She wasn't making any predictions, but basically she's said in the past probably one more quarter point increase, and then they want to leave them there at a high level for the rest of the year. And that's not what Wall Street is expecting.
No, and that next FOMC meeting is just 1 month from this weekend.
Yeah, it seems like a more compressed time period, because we get just one jobs report, one CPI report between the last one and this one, next one. And that's different than what we saw before the March meeting, because we had two of each. So the Fed will have a little bit less data. And of course, the jobs report coming out next Friday is going to be 3 weeks ahead of the Fed. So it's kind of, they're going to be looking at other indicators as well, trying to parse out what is actually happening in the economy at that time.
Gotcha. You know, another piece of the puzzle on labor is all the baby boomers. The New York Fed came out with a report just last week on why there are so many fewer workers out there. And the reason they've come up with is baby boomers during the pandemic just said, you know what? I don't want to get sick. I don't want to travel in. I'm done. And over 2 million spots haven't been filled since the pandemic. And a lot of them are people over 65 that just said, hey, I'm done working.
Yeah, that was a, we were watching a lot of baby boomers retire. We have been for about 10 years. And so it's been a trend. But then it looks like a lot of people just got to the pandemic and they said, go home for a while. And people said, well, I'll just go stay. And so that has cut the number of people available to take jobs. But we've still got so many jobs available that it's it has forced the wage rates up. And now the question is, do we see more people start to come back?
And a lot of people, certainly just to make ends meet, have to come back to the labor force.
Yeah, and there's another group, too, that doesn't get a lot of publicity, but it's the people with long COVID. There's a several hundred thousand estimated who are out of the labor force because they got long COVID. And the hope is that most of them can come back, but it's going to take time. And then this labor shortage just exacerbates the inflation problem. So the combination of the retirees and those who are unable to come back because of their health has really put the economy a little bit behind on the inflation front, among other reasons.
Well, Michael, one last thing I wanted to ask you about is the data that we're seeing in this March report coming up on Friday is from the middle of February, the middle of March, and right around that time is when we saw this banking crisis begin to unfold. How do you think that will affect, if at all, the March report, but are we really going to see something maybe in the April report?
It's going to be interesting timing because the Fed sends out a survey of bank loan officers, and it is usually for the month of April. It would be out in the banks right now. And then they release it the first Monday after the next month, so May 6th. Well, May 3rd is the Fed meeting. But I did ask Susan Collins about it, and she said we would have the Fed would have the data, and they would get a picture of whether or not we're seeing a significant increase in banks raising their lending standards and cutting back on credit. That's going to be an issue. The theory is that banks will cut back on credit, but many had already done that because the economy was slowing. So until they get some proof of it, the Fed isn't going to know whether that actually is going to happen.
Gotcha. Okay, Michael, thank you so much. That's Bloomberg Global Economic and Policy Editor Michael McKeon. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, the long goodbye of the outgoing head of the Bank of Japan. I'm Tom Busby, and this is Bloomberg.
The Capital Ideas Podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Tom Busby in New York. Up later in our program, the U.S. and Ireland in focus. We'll tell you why. But first, changing of the guard about to take place at the Bank of Japan with the longtime head of the central bank stepping down. Bloomberg's global economics and policy editor Kathleen Hayes has covered it all and has this special look back at the ups and downs during his tenure.
Haruhiko Kuroda took over as governor of the Bank of Japan in March of 2013. 2 months before Kuroda took over, the BOJ signed a landmark accord with the former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to reach 2% inflation in the shortest time possible. After being sworn in, he committed to a two-year deadline to reach that target and introduced his bold strategy called quantitative and qualitative easing, the first step in what soon became known as his monetary bazooka. A year later, Kuroda fired another shot, the infamous Halloween surprise, shocking markets as the BOJ nearly doubled its yearly bond purchase target from 50 to 80 trillion yen. In January of 2016, the BOJ narrowly voted to cut its key rate to negative 0.1%. The public backlash was immediate and fierce. 8 months later, the BOJ adopted its most innovative step of all, yield curve control, tying the 10-year Japanese government bond yield to zero, and becoming the first central bank in the world to take this radical monetary step to spur inflation. By the time Kuroda was reappointed, inflation was above zero, but it didn't reach the 2% target. Kuroda then fine-tuned YCC by allowing it to move around double the rate of 10 basis points on either side of zero. In early 2021, concerns were growing after the BOJ became the biggest single holder of Japanese stocks. By September 2022, a weakening in the yen helped boost the BOJ's key inflation metric, reaching 4% by the end of the year. 3 months later, Kuroda rocked markets once again with a surprising decision to widen the 10-year yield band, doubling it to 0.5%. By 2023, investors are already betting some of his ultra-loose policies will be dismantled before long. How history will judge Kurodanomics is still uncertain as a new team prepares to take charge of the BOJ.
Bloomberg's Kathleen Hayes reporting. And for more on Kuroda's legacy and what happens next with Japan's monetary policy, we go to Hong Kong and Bloomberg Daybreak Asia host Brian Curtis.
Tom, Kathleen Hayes joins us now. So a change at the top at the BOJ, long awaited, sometimes feared, and perhaps spring-loaded for a surprise, Kathleen. We got a tease of that from the deputy governor, Shinichi Uchida, who's new in the post. And he said when the time comes for the bank to adjust yield curve control, it may have to be a surprise. That's going to make the run-up to the next meeting quite exciting.
Well, he did say that it may very well be a surprise. I think what he's saying is we're not necessarily going to signal this. Now, in my estimation, to have them do something at the very first meeting would be a surprise. They don't have to do this today. In fact, you notice that bond yields have settled down more. The yen is strengthened again. It doesn't seem like the market's putting a lot of pressure on the BOJ right now. And if they're not going to surprise, here's what kind of surprising to me. What kind of language will Ueda use in his press conference? Because that's where it seems to me they could start opening the door a little bit wider. But I would find it very exciting. I'd love it if they came in at the first meeting and did something significant on yield curve control.
In our piece, we talk about how there might be a massive bond sell-off if this was tipped ahead of time. Might there still be a bond sell-off once it gets announced?
Absolutely. And I think this terrific piece from Ruth Carson, Masaki Kondo, and Michael McKenzie is exactly what they say, that whether you surprise or not, it's going to be a major shift when the Japanese bond holders of overseas bonds, what are their $3.4 trillion fire hose was unleashed on the investment world is how they start their piece. It's going to create waves. Look what's happened. You know, a lot of the run-up to the banking crisis that's going on in the U.S. that fed into Europe now was triggered by the fact that aggressive rate hikes by the Fed, a big balance sheet, all of that, put the bond market, put investors in a position where when something started shifting, even if it wasn't a surprise, it ended up, given a couple of incidental incidences like the SVB meltdown, that is still roiling bond markets.
It's such an interesting outlook at the moment because inflation is actually above target. But the BOJ, both the outgoing governor and the incoming governor, are still saying that the Bank of Japan is trying to get inflation up to 2%, up to the target of 2%. Do you want to try to explain the nuances of that to the audience?
Up to 2% sustainably.
Yes.
Inflation got up to just even over 4% because of fresh food prices, energy prices. Kuroda and the team that was in place, the shift still being made, that's been their position. It's going to start coming down. And in fact, the forecast, one big thing that's going to happen at the first meeting for Ueda is that they're going to revise their outlook for the economy inflation. At the last time they revised it, it was at 1.9 for this year and then below that for next year. That would be significant if they suggest they see it higher. But that's the position. And they're even with wages in the Shunto spring wage negotiations having come in fairly good, maybe even better than previous years, they still don't seem to be convinced the old team that it's going to stay that way. That's another thing we'll get from the new team led by Ueda.
Obviously, it's a lot easier to get inflation up if you have strong growth. What's happening on the growth front at the moment?
I think there are some concerns about growth, and particularly with the prospect of a
global recession. You know, the U.S. Is surely going to get one, according to a lot of Fed watchers and even some Fed officials, that it's maybe not inevitable, but likely to have a recession. What does that mean for the rest of the world? Japan's an exporting nation. So I think that's a concern, too.
So we mentioned that Kazuo Ueda comes in. He's set to take the helm on April 9th. What's the opening message that we might get from him?
The opening message will surely be that they are watching the data, that they can see where it is now, that the path to normalization lies ahead. The question is when normalization will clearly be needed, when it will need to start. And that's the probably the bottom line. You won't say, well, we don't know. It's pretty clear they're going to normalize. But again, that is the question. Are they at a point where they are convinced that inflation is going to stay high and above 2% and that the economy is going to hold in, right, and not start pulling back? And when the conditions of normalization are met, they will surely need to change yield curve control. That's what the deputy governor said, that he said they will surely have to do it, but certain conditions have to be met.
If we take a step back and look at the coordination between the fiscal authorities and the monetary authorities, how do they connect?
The ruling Democratic Party and a lot of those, maybe even the majority, are still on the Abenomics side, right, where you keep rates low. And one of the reasons they want to keep rates low is they've got a big deficit to fund, and they're going to be bringing in a much larger defense budget this year, and they don't want to raise taxes. So I think that's one of the push-pulls right now that is going to have to be dealt with.
Biggest challenge at the moment?
Communication. What pops into my head is that's what everybody has said going into this. Every, you know, person who's been on the BOJ or close to the BOJ, that communication is going to be very critical. They've got to maintain credibility. They've got to guide the markets. They can't overpromise, and they have to be what the markets are going to want. Don't you? Wouldn't you agree, Brian? Because you watch this so closely too. They want to get a sense of the path, right? They want to get a sense of inclination. So how do you give them that without overpromising or saying so much that makes the markets impatient? That's going to be difficult.
Kathleen, thanks so much for joining us. Always a pleasure. Kathleen Hayes, Bloomberg Global Policy and Economy Editor. I'm Brian Curtis. You can catch Doug Krisner and me each weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong and 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Tom?
Thank you, Brian. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, President Biden eyes trips to the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland for a key anniversary. I'm Tom Busby. This is Bloomberg.
The Capital Ideas Podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York. Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C. Bloomberg 991. To Boston. Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco. Bloomberg 960. To the country. Sirius XM Channel 119. To London. DAB Digital Radio. And around the globe. The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend.
I'm Tom Busby in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, a look ahead to what's happening in Washington. But first, President Joe Biden says he intends to travel to the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland to help mark 25 years since the signing of the Good Friday Peace Agreement. For more, let's head to London and bring in Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchor Caroline Hepker.
Tom, the 11th of April is the anniversary of the US-brokered deal that largely brought to an end decades of violence, the so-called Troubles in Northern Ireland. Joining me now is Bloomberg's Dublin Bureau Chief, Morwenna Conyon. Morwenna, thanks so much for being with us. This is a very significant anniversary of the 1998 peace deal, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it marks 25 years, so a quarter of a century, of essentially peace in Northern Ireland, following a period of 3 decades known as the Troubles, which were blighted by sectarian violence and, you know, really damaged the economy, as well as, of course, costing thousands of lives in Northern Ireland.
So how significant is it that President Biden will come to visit both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland?
Yeah, it is something that people are very excited about, the prospect of course. President Clinton, the US president in 1998, was a big part of the original peace deal. So it is a significant occasion for him to be coming to market, particularly, of course, as we have seen so much turmoil in Northern Ireland again over the protocol and the Brexit deal.
Yeah, the UK and the European Union have now signed off on their new Brexit deal that deals with the trade relationship between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK and Northern Ireland and Europe. But that was not sort of without its difficulties. There have been quite a lot of concerns around that. In fact, the Stormont Assembly is still not sitting despite that agreement.
No, indeed it isn't. And so whilst the UK government have signed off on what's known as the Windsor Framework, which was meant to be a way to work around some of the issues in Northern Ireland, the Democratic Unionist Party, which is one of the two parties which required for the current power-sharing assembly at Stormont, they have not accepted that framework, and they are still refusing to participate in the power sharing assembly for Northern Ireland, meaning that there is no devolved government there. And at the moment, you know, they, despite what the UK government have said about this agreement, you know, they are adamant that it doesn't meet their demands. There doesn't seem to be any movement on that from them and other unionist parties. I saw today, you know, the Orange Order have said that they absolutely, you know, do not think that Stormont should be sitting until their concerns about what Brexit means for Northern Ireland are resolved.
Yeah, absolutely. So is there a chance of reconciliation then? You know, you mentioned the objections there of some parts of the community. And yet, of course, everybody's also aware that without devolved government, you know, matters are very difficult for Northern Ireland in terms of self-governance.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a lot of discontent at the moment because, as you said, we don't have them dealing with issues, day-to-day issues, things like setting budgets, things like helping with the cost of living. You know, they are at the mercy of Westminster deciding to try and pass things through, but essentially little is being done. And so other parties are extremely frustrated about that. But if the moment, the way the constitution works is that as the second biggest party and the biggest unionist party, the Democratic Unionists do need to participate. You know, you can't exclude them. So there doesn't seem to be much hope for anything happening anytime soon. That said, other parties, such as the Alliance Party, which is the third biggest party, I spoke to them last week. You know, they said that they would go back in tomorrow, you know, if they could. Despite the fact that, you know, a lot of people would be calling for there to be some sort of discussion about how to prevent this situation occurring again. I think most people who are trying to work to represent communities there do see that some government is better than none and do want to get on with it as soon as possible.
And yet the backdrop to all of this is also very difficult because the terror threat has been raised also in relation to Northern Ireland.
Yes, so that happened yesterday from the UK government. There have been a few incidents in recent months We did see the shooting of an off-duty police officer. There has been some, you know, disquiet. I think that particular incident was attributed to the real IRA, which is seen as a sort of fringe of the original Irish Republican Army on the Republican side. However, there hasn't been wide-scale violence, and it isn't specified exactly what the terror threat relates to. But it was obviously something of concern. It hasn't been. It was lowered, I think, in the early 2020s. So, you know, this isn't something that anybody wants to see, especially ahead of a US presidential visit.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also should be underlined the importance of Joe Biden's stance here, the relationship between Joe Biden and the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. You know, it's really quite pivotal. So I suppose I want to go back to the idea of the importance, the ramifications of Biden actually visiting, spending time, firstly, you know, in Northern Ireland, then in the Republic. But on that idea of Biden's political role, even now, to do with Northern Ireland, the peace agreement and the UK's Brexit?
Yes, I mean, you know, he's seen, the US is seen as being generally very popular in Ireland and Northern Ireland. It's also seen as being a sort of unifying force, so to speak, because it isn't bound up with these historical alliances, and particularly within Northern Ireland, the sense of whether you're British or Irish. So it is incredibly important. It is a very critical time. There had been speculation that if Stormont wasn't sitting, he wouldn't come, but he does seem to be adamant that he does want to come. You know, he said that since the terror threat was raised. It's, you know, it's an incredibly significant moment for him to be coming. And I think overwhelmingly, people are determined to celebrate 25 years of the Good Friday Agreement and of relative peace, rather than focusing on the continuing, you know, divisions and disputes.
And then Biden, who has Irish heritage himself, is also going to be visiting Ireland, and at around the 50th anniversary of when President John F. Kennedy visited Ireland back in 1963. So you've got another anniversary there. So, you know, very, very symbolic days.
So we are looking at the next few weeks, and that is something which I think the state, you know, welcomes very much. It, as you say, it is a historic moment in terms of the first presidential visit, or the 50 years ago presidential visit.
Wenner, one other bit of information that we have is that the Clintons may also visit.
Yes, so the Clintons will be taking part in an event that's being held by Queen's University Belfast the week after the anniversary of the agreement. And of course, that's hugely significant because Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton, was the president who was involved with the signing. And Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State of the United States, I believe has connections to Queen's University Belfast as well. So that's a, you know, hugely significant presence to be there at the event.
Thanks to Morwenna Conyngham, Bloomberg's Dublin Bureau Chief, for joining me. So we await then the arrival of the US President Joe Biden to Northern Ireland and Ireland at a very significant moment, significant anniversary for the island of Ireland. I'm Caroline Hepke here in London. You can catch us every weekday morning for Bloomberg Daybreak. You're beginning at 6 a.m. in London. That's 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Tom.
Thank you, Caroline. And coming up here on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, shaping up to be a busy week ahead in the nation's capital. I'm Tom Busby. This is Bloomberg.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel has become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Tom Busby in New York. Donald Trump will be arraigned in the criminal case against him on Tuesday afternoon following his indictment on Thursday. Sources tell Bloomberg that the former president will hear the charges brought by Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg and will enter a plea of not guilty at a hearing at the New York State Supreme Courthouse. For what we can expect, let's head down to Washington now and hear from Bloomberg Washington correspondent Joe Matthew.
Tom, there are two sides to this issue, political and legal, and so we put together a panel to cover both. I'm joined now by Bloomberg News politics reporter Mike Dorning in Washington and June Grasso, host of Bloomberg Law, with us from New York. June, you're up first. What are you watching for on Tuesday?
I think that you have to remember that Alvin Bragg doesn't want to lose this case. He doesn't want to be the first person who prosecuted a former president and then the first person who lost that prosecution. Yeah. So, and he's a very careful person. And I think that he would not bring this case unless he was sure that he could prove it to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mike Dorning, let's talk politics for a moment, because there is a belief that this will actually help Donald Trump in the near term, maybe help him secure the nomination. Of course, he's leading that race right now. But does this do anything other than galvanize the existing MAGA base?
It definitely helps him in the short term, and it helps not only galvanize his MAGA base around him, but it makes it harder for these lesser known primary candidates, his rivals, to differentiate himself. It's harder for them to attack Trump. Not that it was easy before, but it's super hard now. Mm-hmm. And he's just going to suck up all the political oxygen in these coming months with this case. And so that just makes it harder for them to create their own identities that sell themselves to those voters as distinct winners. But over the long term, I don't think it really does help it.
Is that because they have to kind of support him right now? We saw just about every Republican, never mind every Republican in the race or prospectively in the race, come out to say that this was a horrible moment and a witch hunt.
Yeah, I think most of them feel like they have to support him because a large part of the Republican Party is super fans of Trump. And those people are the people who are most likely to be engaged in primaries, and especially most likely to be engaged politically in this phase of the primary process. So you're talking about the most dedicated, strongest Republicans that matter right now. And those people are really going to be full on, Trump supporters. And you can see that in the political reaction in Congress. You have all the House members who have smaller districts. They're all coming out behind them. Most of the senators, particularly the leaders, are being quiet and trying to stay out of it.
Republicans are not fans of Alvin Bragg, June, and I don't need to tell you that, but we keep hearing the George Soros trope every time his name comes up. But also, you know, an effort to get him to provide materials from the investigation, the three chairs in the Republican-led House have asked for here.
And they can
keep
doing that.
He's firing back, of course. He's not going to do that.
They can keep asking.
Well, they also remind us that he was running on this from the beginning. Put that in context for our listeners. How true is that?
See, as I remember his campaign, it wasn't focused on Trump at all. In fact, when he was asked that question, he'd say, that's something I may have to consider in the future, so I can't speak about it. Now, when he was part of the state attorney general's office, he did lead or pursue a case against Trump, a civil case at that point. But I don't remember his campaign at all being based on that. I mean, he was running on things like the bail bond and things like that, and having a more open prosecution in, prosecutor's office, more open to lowering the charges against certain people. I mean, he didn't run on Trump at all.
Many thanks to Bloomberg Law host June Grasso and Bloomberg political reporter Mike Dorning. A lot to watch in the coming week. Tom?
All right. Thank you, Joe. Bloomberg Sound On host Joe Matthew reporting from our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington. And you can hear Sound On daily from 1 to 3 p.m. Wall Street time right here on Bloomberg Radio. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 a.m. Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Tom Busby. Stay with us. Top stories and global business headlines are coming up right now.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/FutureInvestor/radio.